Insomnia episode where Namita is guesting. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks so much for having me, Danielle.
And, you know, just very briefly, the reason I found you was actually through one of our viewers who found some of your content, and I was really interested in it. So thanks so much for being here. And for those of you who don't know you, just tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, sure. I'd love to. Well, thanks again for having me. This is very exciting. I'm looking forward to it. So I am an anxiety educator and a strategist. My general theme in life is to support individuals in their growth and healing. So I do a bunch of things, like I'm supporting women in their nutrition and health goals. I'm also a domestic violence counselor in California, supporting families who've been through domestic violence. And in our context over here, you know, this is something so close to my heart, the topic of anxiety. So I work with individuals who have experienced anxiety in their life and are looking for support because they've been through a lot, and we want to make sure that we extend the kind of support that's helpful. And I'm grateful to be a part of that conversation and that sort of mission.
100%, absolutely. And now let's start there. Actually, like what people are always curious about, and I'm curious about too, is of course, what led you to this?
Yes. As is not uncommon, the journey before has been personal. So I have experienced anxiety in my own life, and I know up close and personal how difficult it can be. It's a very difficult state to be in. So just like everybody else, I did try to reach out and get support when things became unmanageable. It's something that you don't quite understand and you reach out. It's a natural thing to do. And fortunately or unfortunately, during that time, I found that the support that was around wasn't quite adequate. There were definitely useful tips and suggestions out there on how to manage this, but I generally found that it doesn't quite come close to a true understanding of anxiety. And I had to take it upon myself to figure this out. So in that path, I did try to understand what was going on and supported myself in my own healing and path out of anxiety. And, you know, as you can imagine, that in that work, when you go through all of that, your natural motivation is then to support others who are going through the same thing. So that's how I got started. I started with my website and started putting content out there, which is still around. And that's primarily how people reach me. They read up on things that they read on my website. And then, you know, we take it further with courses or coaching or whatever kind of personal support they need.
100%. And I've heard that story numerous times when it comes to, numerous times maybe exaggeration, but many times with insomnia. My good friend Martin Reed, you know, who many of the audience knows, same story. And Sasha Stevens, who was a guest here recently, same story, went through it themselves and then decided to, like, I got to share the word and spread it to others. But staying a little bit on that topic, like, you know, how long ago was it that you struggled? And I think you went through the traditional kind of like trying medications, or what was your journey like? A little bit more detail there.
Well, I can remember anxiety for as long as I've been around. It's just that I haven't quite, and this is again, not quite uncommon. I didn't quite have the words for what it is that I'm experiencing. So, I mean, even in my early life, in my early years, there were difficult feeling states, and it was incomprehensible. It was very difficult to understand what was going on. And I'm also, I come from a different time, a different place. I live in the United States now, but I'm from India. And generally the environment around, there wasn't quite access to the kind of help that you need. And what was more difficult was that you don't even quite understand what was going on. So I did experience anxiety for a long time, and then reached a point where it was unmanageable. And then I did start looking for whatever support was around. So a long time. And it's been a journey and lots of discoveries, lots of growth as well.
And speaking of that, like, when did things start kind of turning around, and when did you start understanding, and how, what was it that kind of made things turn around?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think what made things really turn around was looking back at one's experiences with anxiety and also really objectively evaluating the kind of support that you've been getting, whether it's with the professionals like doctors and so on. I think the industry is great. It's very well intentioned, and there are some excellent doctors and therapists around. But at least in my experience, and I'm told this from a lot of people who are in contact with me as well, that it takes a while to find the right kind of help. And that was certainly my case too. So it was very frustrating, in addition to walking around carrying the struggles of anxiety. It's a painful state to be in. So I reached a point where I was like, I know what doesn't work. I generally know from my experience that people around don't quite understand what is going on. I am not going to go into one more meeting or group or session or whatever it is, with all due respects, because I know that hasn't worked for me. So it is something literally I had to take it on upon myself and say, it's either you try to figure this out by yourself or it is what it is, kind of a thing. And that was the turning point, because I stopped doing the things that didn't work. And I was on a path to figure out what is going to work. And that was a huge benefit. And this is what I say to anxiety clients as well, that it's very difficult to accept that so much time has passed and you're struggling with the same issues, and they have actually spiraled into a whole life in themselves. But you actually need your history to be able to do it correctly going forward, because what you know very well is what doesn't work. And we need you to accept, admit, like sign it off, write it off and say, okay, this doesn't work. I got to try something else.
And what is, like, can you give me some examples? Like, what are the things that generally speaking, don't work?
Absolutely, absolutely. That's a great question. And I love that. And this is probably going to open up a big discussion between you and me right now. But I generally think that the more common route people take to solve their anxiety is a cognitive route. And that, long story short, in my opinion, has its limits. And it's very difficult to recognize this. I mean, you need a lot of support to recognize this. And then you need an equal amount of support, if not more, to be flexible to move away from that. So let me tell you what I mean by the cognitive route. In anxiety, we have recognized that our greatest struggle is with our thoughts, with our thinking. When someone shows up for help for anxiety, they're in a very painful state with disturbing thoughts, irrational thoughts, distorted thoughts. And they're also in an equally challenging position to sort of have the good sense and the rationality to understand that their thoughts are unsupportive, but they don't know why they're still struggling when they have the logic to know that their thoughts are sort of wrong or distorted. Now, what happens in this is that people keep focusing on the assumption that the solution is in the area of cognition. I gotta work on fixing what's wrong with my, what's wrong with me? Why can't I win over my thoughts? Why don't they stop? Why are they saying what they're saying when that's not true? And in this sort of, in recognition of this and in their pursuit to solve this problem, they focus the solution again on the cognitive route, which is let me do whatever it takes to silence these thoughts, to polish them up, to whitewash them, to discipline them. And this is a kind of war, a mental struggle, a battle, a war that, in my opinion, it cannot be won. And research backs this up as well. There's new research, the third wave research in particular, acceptance and commitment therapy, dialectical behavior therapy, as well as the research that supports those modalities and frameworks, which is, in my opinion, really convincing, which shows that, you know, you don't need to battle your thoughts and win over your thoughts, because that's an impossible fight to win. Instead, you need to do something else. And that's where that, and that's what I support as well. And what is that something else? I believe that we have to shift from cognition over to the behavior route. The behavior route sounds simplistic, and it does involve a lot of courage on the part of our clients, people struggling with anxiety. But essentially what the behavior route says is that stop fighting the mind. Be a little bit more flexible with having this sort of distorted thoughts around. Increase your flexibility to allow them to exist within you, but move in the direction towards your values and your goals. Move in the direction towards the things that matter to you, despite your symptoms, with your symptoms, not after you have won over your symptoms. And when you start doing that, essentially you are like taking back control of your life, which is eventually what anybody ever wanted. It just gets a little bit fuzzy and blurry to see that. But what we basically want, which is what anxiety has posed as such a big threat, is that your life is on hold. The things that you want to do, you're not able to do. When we start becoming open to this idea that, you know, I do have flexibility to do things that I want to do despite my thoughts and symptoms and feelings and emotions and urges and memories and, you know, the quintessential definition of anxiety, then you're on a different path. And what eventually happens with this is it's a very scientific process. If we were to see the brain under brain scans, this actually does tend to work, because what we are showing to our emotional brain centers, which are fired up falsely in, for the most part, falsely in anxiety, is that even so, I am not under threat, because I do have a capacity to do the things that I want to do. And when we show our emotional brain centers experiential proof, and that's most critical, because nothing short of that is convincing to our anxiety. When we show the real proof that our behaviors are happening despite our symptoms, essentially we're showing that we're not under threat. And then paradoxically, our alarm centers get trained to learn that this particular stimulus, this particular trigger is not really a threat. And this guy, this person is proving it by walking around in his life as if he's not under threat. And that's the kind of proof we need, like our nervous system needs to see to refigure, and the alarm centers, the false alarms, like they stop blowing their horns that much.
Wow, yeah, 100%. I think I completely followed, and it made total sense to me. Let's say there were a couple follow-up questions, of course, like you predicted here. Let's start with this one. So you talk about, you know, thoughts and how they're distorted, they're maybe incorrect, and they kind of like they're bombarding you all the time. And then you also talk about anxiety. Like, where, I guess I'll just put it this way, like the way I teach and the way I think is that, you know, thoughts produce feelings, thoughts produce emotions. Is that how you think of it as well?
I think it's a, I tend to believe that it's a little bit more intricate. It's a little bit more integrated. And it, at some point it becomes very hard to know what precedes what, because by the time, typically when people are showing up for help, they're in a lot of pain. They know that their thoughts are causing them pain, but sometimes they're also just waking up with a lot of pain, which are then leading to difficult feeling states and difficult thoughts. So I do believe that both affect each other, and it tends to be true for most people. But absolutely, our thinking, our thoughts, like you're saying, is a source of the. It can tend to be the starting point of our troubles.
You know, Absolutely. And as I'm asking that question, maybe, you know, as I'm saying that, I'm thinking maybe you would think that, like, even the way I asked that question, like, are thoughts producing anxiety? Maybe that in itself is part of the problem, because you're kind of trying to figure out what is causing what. It's, would you agree with that?
I do tend to agree with that, particularly like in my work, I make a proposal to separate to the clients, to separate history from our forward direction. So in the history, all of this could be true. We could have started off quite innocently in our lives. We got bombarded with some sorts of challenging thoughts. Our logical reactions was to solve them, figure them out. And that tends to lead to the path of training ourselves to do a lot of reassurance, which then causes an anxiety problem in the long run. So that could have been the case. But then when that happens, when a person is grappling with anxiety for a little while, and they can attest to this, is that you sort of are constantly in a state of hypervigilance, flight, fight, emotional responses. And that's just pure raw feeling states. This is very typical for people who wake up, after sleeping, and they report a lot of difficult symptoms. And this makes total sense. They have a history of anxiety. They have been training themselves and their emotional brains and their nervous systems with anxiety behaviors. They are in a fight flight response. It makes absolute sense that they can wake up feeling horrible. And that then leads to difficult thoughts. So the chicken and an egg thing is complicated, it's complex. But in the forward movement of our work, at some point, I believe that we got to let this go.
Exactly, right, yeah.
It doesn't
really matter, right?
Doesn't matter.
Exactly, yeah. 100%. And now you said something that, I think you said this almost in passing. I think it made total sense to me, but just let's stay there for a second, because I think this is really important. You said that it can start with something kind of innocent, some you're bombarded with thoughts, and then that leads to you kind of like, you know, reassuring yourself, and then that leads to an anxiety problem. Can you expand on that?
Oh, sure, absolutely. And this is very interesting, because I'm trying to make a proposal to people to let go of some of the heavy burden and blame and guilt that they carry around for being responsible, entirely and utterly responsible for their anxiety problems. In a large part, sometimes I feel our slips into anxiety are by accident. And I'll tell you what that means, which answers your question before, is it's a very natural human thing to problem solve. That's the way our brains work. In the external world, this is a huge gift. It's a tool. We problem solve. Like, you and I wanted to meet. We have thoughts about when we meet. We make a decision about when we meet. We're doing a lot of problem solving just in this benign, silly example. But this is the way we go around in our lives, problem solving. The challenge becomes that when we are struck with internal states, our internal mind is, and emotions are posing questions to us in the form of thoughts, questions that are asking us or challenging us about our safety and survival and just sense of being. These questions, we then try to solve with the same problem solving techniques. Let me silence them. How do I silence these thoughts other than reassure them? And therein, we give a lot of reassurance, but we make the assumption that this is the right path. This is the right way of doing it, because we don't know anything else. Now, so for example, for the person who eventually goes on to develop hypochondria, it's quite clear that they exist in their lives with a value system that honors well-being and their health. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. It is something to be actually quite proud of. Except that what happens is that when they have thoughts about their health, the normal thing to do is answer them by getting a medical test. You get it done, you solve it, the thoughts silence. But very gradually, you are training yourself to answer all your thoughts with evidence and reassurances. Again, it's not so black and white. There's really nothing wrong with it. And this is where I really propose people to let go of the judgment, to say, you know, there has to be something that, you know, I did everything wrong. Actually, not quite. Things were on the right path. But at some point, you have moved over to finding safety only by reassuring any and all your thoughts. And that starts to become a problem because your regular life starts to go on hold. So if a person gets one medical test just because of the thought that they had saying, you know, what if something is wrong with you? Get your heart checked. They got their heart checked. Everything was clear. Then that's where you have to start paying attention. When everything is clear, and then you have extended thoughts after that saying, well, what if the doctor was wrong? What if he doesn't know what he's talking about? What if I go to a different hospital and, you know, get something just to be even a little bit more sure? Like, what's wrong with that? There's nothing wrong with that. That's when you have to start catching it. Because what's happening over here is that you have started to train your thoughts with assurances. And when we start doing that, our thoughts become a little bratty. They start becoming a little spoiled. They start asking for more and more and more. And this game, like this route, leads to pain in the long run. It's in the short run, it can work. It's an illusion that it's all working. Unfortunately, you know, the time horizon is so stretched out that people can't quite catch it. And years pass where they are conditioning themselves with these reassurance behaviors, thinking that they're doing absolutely the right thing. And at some point they're like, oh my gosh, what do I do now with these new thoughts that I simply cannot answer? And that's when all hell breaks loose in their lives. It's a very difficult state to be in.
Absolutely. It's you know, it's always so, it's very, I don't know what word to use here, but it's I guess get a word of fascinating or interesting, or like the way you're describing it is like, I understand it like 1000%. It's exactly the same with insomnia. It's exactly the same. It's like you have a perceived threat. You try to escape the threat. It doesn't work because it's not a real threat. The threat becomes larger. You have to escape it more, and then you're in this cycle again. So I think,
absolutely.
I think with that said, I think it's very clear, hopefully, to everyone that's tuning in here, what we're talking about, what the root of the problem is, which is sort of like seeking safety when there's no real threat or something to that effect, right?
Right.
And then, now, moving towards like, okay, I, if I understand your sort of like big picture teaching, if you will, is that no, we have to leave that problem solving behind and just go in the direction of doing things that you enjoy, that you want to do, despite those thoughts, feelings that you have. And then you're teaching yourself sort of that there is really no threat out there, and then things get better. Is that kind of what you're teaching is in a way?
Generally, yes. Overall, move from understand the limits of being able to solve anxiety by just using the mind and the cognitive route, and start moving towards the things that matter, the behaviors that matter, and paired with the symptoms, with the thoughts, with the feelings. And paradoxically, that's what is going to help in a probably greater way than the other route of trying to first like discipline your mind and say, you know, how dare you say this? How dare you talk to me in that way? I better fix you, the thoughts, the mind, before I can do anything else.
Absolutely. And I just have to remind myself, a mental note here, that we should go back to judgment and self-kindness. That's so important. But before we do, and maybe we go there now, who knows? But what I wanted to ask you was, okay, I can hear someone who's struggling a lot now think, okay, I get what you're saying, but how can I do things that are like enjoyable to me when I am always exhausted and these thoughts are always with me and I'm in this state of struggle? How can I go towards doing something I enjoy when I feel this way? What do you respond to like those type of questions?
First of all, they're right. They feel horrible, and they should be granted a lot of respect and compassion when they're describing those feeling states. I know that there's a lot of popular advice out there which sounds something like, just do it, you know?
Right.
Jump in, just jump. And it's, for someone who's going through anxiety, this is impractical. It's not some very sound advice. I mean, it's almost there, but it's it needs a little bit more compassion than just that. Compassion is one important one part, and also a little bit more understanding of what's going on. And that's where they might need support from someone who gets it. Now, to answer the question about, and I've been there too, it's like, I feel this way. What are you talking about? Like, do this. Don't you understand? It's not possible for me to do this. It is possible to move in that direction. It requires us to be a little bit more psychologically flexible, willing, and accepting. Like, these are psychological skills. These are certain sorts of foundational motivations that we have. And if we do, then things start to become a little bit more possible. It's not going to be easy in the beginning, particularly because in anxiety, it's a very difficult feeling state. You know, even if we put the thoughts aside, it's a very difficult feeling state. And despite all of that, it is possible to move in the direction of your values and your goals and the behaviors that you want to do. You just need a little bit of support. So what I like to offer people in this path is, one, a massive education about anxiety. It's like one of the biggest reasons that they have interpreted that moment to say, I cannot do it, is because they have a misunderstanding about the mind. They have a misunderstanding about how thoughts work, how emotions work, you know. And once we start to clear out the misunderstanding, they will start to see a little bit of this illusion that's been created by the mind. This illusion, which has over time translated into a lot of judgmental, evaluative conclusions, even about yourself. Like, someone who's trying to grapple with their anxiety and come out of it is struggling with confidence, hope, is self-esteem. They don't believe that things would be possible because, you know, they have suffered for so long. So the job of a good support person is to hear all of that, understand how this has happened with them over time, but yet give them the support and the education that they need to understand that this is not quite the correct 100% true picture. Your thoughts are not entirely correct. They are distorted. Your feeling states, and this is where we go into a particular module where we talk about the belief systems of the anxious person. There are 8 core belief systems. And one of them is, well, there are several of them, and they're operating in the person's life while they are trying to recover. So we have to help them understand these distortions. They are doing a lot of emotional reasoning. They are believing that their past equals to the future. They are underestimating their coping skills. They are overvaluing. They're putting a lot of importance to wanting 100% certainty in order to feel safe, and so on and so forth. So we have to support them in that moment to challenge their belief systems, to challenge the assumptions that they're making about mental health. And then the other tool that I really do believe in and offer to support people in going towards the behaviors that they want to do is to grade their behaviors. So, I mean, this is common in exposure and response therapy, where we build hierarchies. We don't jump into the just do it sort of a leap, because for some people, it could work for some people, but for others, it's impossible, and that's okay. So we go slow. We literally work together, and the client partners in this. I mean, they have to take the lead in this. And we build a behavior plan. We grade the smaller behaviors. And once the skills are built in that, when you expose yourself to like less risky behaviors, and you find yourself doing absolutely, you know, okay, generally okay, you find that sense of safety. Therein, it gives you the confidence to keep going in the direction of your, you know, your ultimate path. So I think it's very important for people to keep in mind that they, if they have to overcome anxiety, they don't have to do it in one quick, you know, rushed stroke. Like someone who has a fear of driving on the freeways, like their ultimate goal is to drive on the freeways. And for one person, this could simply look like, I'm sick of how much I have lost to anxiety in my life. Give me that car, come with me, and I'm doing this. But for the other, and that's cool. You know, it's possible to do it. It depends on the person. It depends on what they've been through and what their motivations and goals are and the current skills that and tools that they have at their disposal. But for another person, this can feel impossible. So they go slower. They can decide to, I mean, for some hierarchies, as Danielle, you might be familiar with this as well, like some of our hierarchies, the triggers are so extreme that the starting point to the work of helping yourself to reaching that end goal could simply mean even looking at a YouTube video of someone on the freeway driving. You know, and people deserve a lot of respect for that. Someone going through this, like for them, this is a very difficult thing to do. But it doesn't mean that we can't go there. But we start small and we build up.
Yeah, I mean, very well said. And you know, I have to ask you about this one now. Like this is, you know, when it comes to insomnia, I'm sure it's the same with anxiety, is that you walk this kind of paradoxical tightrope between asking people to, you know, shift their attention and do like, but do something you enjoy, but then don't do that thing you enjoy so that you sleep more, right? Yeah. And I'm sure it must be the same thing you say to somebody, do something you enjoy during the day, but you're not doing that to be less anxious, right? Do you find that similar?
And that's what I found remarkable in your videos and in the things that you propose as well, that when we create rules to sleep, to help ourselves to sleep, we've just made it slip further away from us. So the solution to insomnia, in my opinion, is also, and I've been through insomnia, it's a very difficult state to be in. It's very difficult. But actually the counterintuitive solution to this is that you have to care less about sleeping. You just have to care less about sleeping. And I know that the person who shows up, who's looking for help to sleep, this is the worst thing that you can tell them. And it's very annoying to hear advice like this. It could be. But I think people looking at their own experiences, if they've had enough, they will realize that it's probably the right path. But absolutely. The more you care about sleeping, and if you're doing all these things with one eye on like, if I do these things so that I can sleep at night better, it's likely not gonna work.
Exactly right. It's funny, I think, you know, when I started my YouTube channel, you know, maybe 2 years ago or something, it took me a long while. It took me a year or something like that before I started realizing that, wait a minute, what I'm saying about insomnia, it really applies to anxiety too, or hyperarousal. It's almost the same thing. I think that I could probably become a pretty good anxiety coach now, and you could become a great insomnia coach, because it's literally the same thing, right?
It is the same thing. It is identified as an anxiety problem as well. Like insomnia is like a subtype of a broad anxiety.
That's how I look at it too. And by the way, I want to ask you, you know, and I'm going to preface this by saying I'm a medical doctor. That's my background, sleep doctor. But literally what I talk about with insomnia has nothing to do with being a doctor. It's just literally my little bit of understanding that I got from fellowship, plus basically I'm self-taught. But what's your background?
With insomnia?
No, with anxiety. Like, do you have any formal training, or you're just kind of like a peer support type?
Essentially, it's peer support. My offerings, which people tell me are what I believe to be the contributions in their journeys, is that I've been through this nonsense and for so long, and at some point I figured out how to work out a path out of it. So I mean, that's what I offer, and if it works for people, like that's just the greatest feeling to hear from them, that like, someone gets it and that it started to shift. Their anxiety started to untangle and things started to make sense.
100%. Nothing is better. It's such a sweet reward. I got an email today from someone who's so nice. But anyway, I wanted to ask you about two things. Oh, yeah. I think we're doing pretty good on time here, so I can ask a couple more questions. I thought, you know, one thing I learned from, I think there was a video you had on your Facebook page where you basically said something that ended with, so anxiety is really just a little misunderstanding or a confusion. You used one of those two words. And I was just like, I love that. So I've been starting to say that myself. I'm like, it's just a little confusion. That's all it is. But well, if you could like boil it down for people, like what do you mean by that? Or what is the confusion, if you will?
Well, the confusion is kind of the things that we talked about. They are operating with certain assumptions about how the process should work. It is intuitive, it's logical, it's a human brain thing. I have a question in my mind, I have a thought, it disturbs me, I solve it. And that's intuitive and that makes complete sense. It's actually a sign of sanity, you know? And that's what I like to tell people with anxiety is that you're really brilliant. You are, and Danielle, you would know this. There are so many studies that correlate IQs with worries and people who go on to worry and develop anxiety. You know, correlation, of course we can't do cause and effect in any of these studies, but it makes absolute sense. I have seen in my experience that we are analytical and we have questions and our thoughts are active. And the misunderstanding happens is when we take them as literal truths and follow the intuitive process, the intuitive assumption that we have to solve questions in our mind. We have a thought, solve it. And that's the misunderstanding. And this is a slippery slope. And this, it was particularly revealed to me when I read the relational frame theory, which is the research program of acceptance and commitment therapy. This is an impossible war. It works very well when we are grappling and when we're dealing with things in our external world. But the minute it becomes our goals with our emotions, like thoughts come, feelings come, emotions come. When we try to solve them just with the mind, this is a slippery slope. And then what happens is that we put our behaviors on hold, which is the probably the most wrong thing that we can do. Because when we put our behaviors on hold, like for example, if someone is prone to having panic attacks, like say if they go to the supermarket or they're claustrophobic or, you know, social anxiety when they are dealing with a lot of new people and new situations, the natural, and they have a thought that says, people will not like me. And that raises my anxiety levels and I don't want to be in this place. Even though I want to, I don't want to be in this place. So you answer your thoughts by avoiding situations, by suppressing situations. And in some cases by overcompensating by doing a lot of reassurance behaviors. So in all of this, the end result becomes that we have compromised on the goals and the behaviors that we wanted to do. So the person who did want to go to the networking event, but is afraid of meeting new people, has social anxiety, worries about what people think, worries about too much about how he or she is presenting themselves over there, will have raised their anxieties to such a high level that they will not go. They may decide to not go. And that's where they've started to compromise on their life. And why is this happening? This is happening because they had a thought that says, I'm not good enough and people will not like me. Now, this is a distorted thought. We have to give our clients a little bit of respect by honoring the fact that this thought could exist because of circumstances in their history. They're not silly to show up with thoughts in their heads which are challenging them. However, for their directions going forward, they have to consider this thought as a distortion and not take it as a gospel truth. If we are truly honest, we don't know the future. We have to admit that we don't know the future, that going to an event and everything turning out just fine is a possibility. We don't know for sure that it will be a disaster. Similarly, the thought that says people will not like me, it's a black and white kind of thought. We don't know that they won't like you. And also, generally people, healthy people aren't that way. So that's not necessarily that the response that they will receive when they put themselves out in the world. So these sorts of belief systems have to be challenged. But look at what the technicality that's happening in the case of the person is that they're taking the thoughts too literally and then avoiding life. And then they've caught themselves in a vicious cycle, which has to be broken out of. And the path to break out of it is to start sort of accepting these distorted thoughts in your mind, instead of suppressing, pushing them away, challenging them too much, and then going forward towards life. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes total sense. And you know, I'm smiling because it is that it is so tricky, as you say, because on one hand, you say, because you have to challenge your thoughts, but on the same hand, like, you don't want to like attack them and challenge them like that. It's like you have to accept them. But it makes total sense. And I think the way you chose the name of your website, like Unlearning Anxiety, it really resonated with me, because that's what I've come to believe myself too, that it is with insomnia, you know, it's really an education. It's like, because, you know, I believe very much in the, like, going towards things you enjoy, but as you said, you can't go there immediately, because if you don't understand what's happening, then the act of doing something you enjoy just becomes kind of another way of escaping, or you don't understand it. So it has to be like, you have to educate, right? It, understand it, and then letting go becomes much easier.
Absolutely. I think you and I agree on this. The precursor to this work is, it's like a massive education that a person needs about how anxiety works, generally.
Yeah, exactly.
Come before we do other things.
Exactly. Anyway, I went into like a little place in my mind there very briefly, because yesterday this thought came to me, like, you know, you always say like awareness precedes change, which I generally believe in, you know, you understand something that can lead to change. But then I thought, like, in a way, like, awareness is change already, right? When you learning, that is change. You already started the journey when you started learning.
That's true. I think the challenge that some people innocently get stuck in is by assuming that awareness will sort of change those automatic response, the automatic thoughts from before. And this is sometimes where I find people find themselves trapped, even when they're doing practices like mindfulness and meditation and so on. And I think, Daniel, you speak to this as well in your videos, that when we are doing things, the right things, but with the wrong goal, is that my mind has to be absolutely scrubbed clean. It must not say anything nasty to me. It must not question me. It must not, challenge my safety. It should just be clean, you know? And we're doing all these awareness and practices with that one eye on that prize, saying that's what I'm going to get from out of this. It doesn't work.
100%, like, totally related to that. And let's go back to which I didn't want to forget, which was like kind of judgment and self-kindness. And, you know, I'll just share one thing that I've thought about lately and let you comment on this, of course, which was that, let's say insomnia, and I'm sure it's the same with anxiety, but with insomnia, it's often like, if you, for a lot of people, it's not clear why they start having trouble sleeping, or maybe you've had anxiety for a long time. For some people, it's really kind of obvious it started here. Right. But in a way, I believe it almost always started with this kind of, like, in lack of a better word, I haven't come up with a better word, is like micro judgment. Let's say there was this one time where you didn't sleep that much and your brain went like, that's not right. Something went wrong there. You should have slept a little more. And you excuse to say, kind of like very innocent, it was like this micro judgment, but there was a little judgment there. You were saying, this is not right, this is wrong. And then from that micro judgment comes, like, you know, the attempts at solving. And then, you know, but what I want to go over here is, like, judgment in itself can sound judgmental. And I don't want to, of course, everything should be like completely avoid of that. But I think there is some truth to say that it anxiety, depression, all these mental health issues, they kind of start with this kind of micro judgment. Or do you agree?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And the assumption, again, it's almost not anyone's fault, because this is like the popular what's the word here? It's just what we hear all around, mental health. You know, it's like, what is good mental health? What is it? Like, who's to decide this? I mean, I know exactly. That we don't want to be depressed. We don't want to be anxious. That can be a given, because those are painful feeling states. But coming to insomnia, it will sound ludicrous to someone asking for help for sleep. For us, you and me, to tell them, who says you have to sleep? Like, where's the compulsion to sleep? There's no rule around in this life that you have to sleep. Now, we know biologically sleep is critical. It's important. It's restful. It helps us recover. But we also know with someone who's going through anxiety is that they are so vigilant about their sleep that even if they whiff in the direction of their, you know, even a small sniff or whiff in that direction will affect their sleep. They're so vigilant about it. So counterintuitively, we want to propose to them that there is no rule in this life, in this world, that you have to sleep. So you're right. We want to remove the judgments, the micro judgments that it's not just as you would have seen in your practice. They don't just have judgments about whether they're sleeping well. It's also how much they're sleeping. Like, I used to sleep 8 hours. Now I only get 4 hours. This is a problem. It doesn't have to be a problem if you're okay with sleeping 4 hours. Yeah. So the judgments have to be relaxed a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. And which then leads to, I'm going to kind of present another little thing, which by the way, I'm going to do like a complete separate episode on just this one. It came to me just the other day, but it was this one. So a lot of people are very kind of frustrated, and frustration really is like, sort of like, you're angry at yourself for being unable to achieve something, right? Like, you're frustrated, angry. Why can't I get this done? Why couldn't I have done this? And for me, it's often like, I only slept like 2 hours. Like, I'm so angry. I'm so frustrated. And now here's the thing, that you have zero control over sleep. Like, literally no human being on this planet can control their sleep, mm-hmm. which actually logically leads to, when you're angry at yourself for not being able to sleep, you're angry at yourself for doing something that is humanly impossible, which leads to what I'm thinking lately is that being angry at yourself, in a way, without any kind of belittling or judgment, being angry at yourself is sort of ridiculous. It's kind of ridiculous, because you're angry at yourself for doing something that is impossible. Yeah. What do you think of that?
Yes, I think self-anger is, the more we minimize that in general, the better we're going to feel about ourselves. And then to hold yourself to impossible standards, you know, it would be very counterproductive to adopt that sort of a position on yourself. I am angry because I only sleep 2 to 3 hours a night. And while it's also true that no one can control their sleep, but I'm angry because I can't control my sleep.
Right.
So yeah, you know, we do have to, like, generally with all these difficult anxiety, insomnia, and depressed feeling states, there's already such a difficult experience that we're carrying around. Wherever there's an opportunity to let go of some of that blame, shame, guilt, burden, I say, like, just latch on and go for it. Reduce the self-judgment, reduce the anger turn inwards, and try your best.
100%. That self-kindness, so I think it's so foundational, really.
Also,
so very cool. So I think that we ended on a really nice note, self-kindness. And before I let you go, like, for somebody who hears this and is interested in, like, you know, I think I would like to work more with Namita. Where can they find you?
Oh, sure. I'd be, they can find me on my website, which is unlearninganxiety.com. And if they want to go straight into the kind of perspectives and tools that I offer, they are welcome to download my book. In fact, for your audience, I would be happy. We spoke so much about the behavior path. I'd be happy to offer a book. It's the 5 steps why the why facing your fears don't work. And this is sort of like my tools that I offer to people to proactively help them prepare for what the path ahead is. So I offer that to your people. If they want to start doing the Anxiety Academy course, which is my step-by-step program, where it's a massive education about anxiety. We cross four particular milestones, and eventually it loops to building your behavior plan. So, you know, they're welcome to start. This is a self-paced guided program, which they can start right away whenever they're ready.
Sounds wonderful. Now, of course, I'll put the links in the show notes here. So, Namita, it was really, really wonderful talking to you. And so thanks so much for coming on, and I'm sure we'll talk more in the future.
Thanks so much for having me. Great work, Daniel, you're doing, you and your team. I know there's another coach. This is really important. And thanks for having me involved and a part of this conversation.
Anytime. You take care now.
Okay. Bye now.